Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Science Friday is supported by Random House, publisher of When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi, a memoir from a doctor turned patient about the fragile beauty of our mortal lives. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is available at prh.com/air.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Later in the hour, the sky is filled with birds making their way south for the season. Do you need help IDing that backyard brown bird? Or have you spotted something you haven't seen before and you'd like to talk about it? We're here to help. Give us a call with your birding questions. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or you can tweet us at SciFry. But first, President Trump and congressional leaders have spoken repeatedly about doing away with what they call the previous administration's war on coal. And they're introducing policies that downplay environmental concerns in an attempt to be more friendly to the fossil fuel businesses. But in some cases, the key decisions are not the ones Washington makes, but the ones made by big banks and institutional investors. And some of those financial decision makers have decided to divest their investments away from fossil fuels. Joining me now to talk about that is Bill McKibben. He's co-founder of 350.org, author of a recent op-ed in the New York Times talking about financial players and the environment. Bill McKibben joins us via Skype. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Ira, best of the season to you.
Thank you very much. Does banking and investment have a lot to do with energy policy? Can they influence energy policy?
Yeah, well, you know what they say, follow the money. Right now, of course, politics is making it difficult to deal with climate change in D.C., but it's not stopping cold all the work that's going on. There's a lot of really interesting developments in the last, even in the last few months. You know, we started this campaign asking institutions to divest their holdings in fossil fuels about 5 years ago. It's gone very well. It's become the largest of this kind of a campaign ever, with about $5 trillion in endowments and portfolios already committed. But man, is it gaining steam now. In November, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is the biggest pool of money on the planet, said it was beginning to divest from fossil fuel. That's particularly interesting because they made all their money in oil, you know, that North Sea oil that they have up there, Ira. And in essence, they said, we're taking our winnings from this fossil fuel casino, we're cashing out, and we're going to go find some other game to play in. The smart money is increasingly moving in that direction. Just this past week, since I wrote that piece in the Times, we had what may be the biggest news yet. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on Tuesday announced that the state's common fund, its huge pension fund, $200 billion, would no longer be making new investments in fossil fuel and would begin the process of decarbonizing its entire portfolio. Half an hour after he made that announcement, Scott Stringer, who is the comptroller of the city of New York and in charge of its almost $200 billion pension fund, said they were going to do the same thing. Those are two of the 20 largest funds on the planet. So the same day that in Washington they were passing the tax bill that gave ludicrous tax breaks to the fossil fuel industry, in the world center of finance, New York, they were saying, nah, we don't think this is good business anymore.
I don't have $200 billion if I'm a normal folk. Can a little investor make a difference at all?
sure, people have been divesting themselves and in such numbers that all the big financial firms have set up fossil-free funds. And of course, what's interesting is that over the last 5 years, those funds have done a lot better than those that were exposed to fossil fuel because fossil fuel hasn't been performing. The bottom dropped out of the coal business. Almost all the big players went bankrupt. And the oil and gas business is in the dumps too. Why? Because smart investors looking ahead can see where the future lies. I mean, Elon Musk is starting to build cars in volume that do not need you to put petroleum in the side in order for them to work. That's a real threat to the way that we've been doing business for a very long time, not to mention the fact that, you know, the melting Arctic, the blazing hills of California, the dissolving corals around the world, those are putting huge pressure, if not on Donald Trump, on the rest of world leaders to begin to actually do something about this, not to mention the fact that with every passing month, the cost of a solar panel gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. The fossil fuel industry, which has been an awful good business for the last 200 years, isn't a good business going forward. And the smart money is heading for the exits now.
But is the money going into green energy as it heads to the exits?
Some of it's, I'm sure, just going into, you know, I don't know what, you know, investing in bowling alleys or pizza places or something. But some of it, yes, is definitely going into investing in green energy because that's where the returns are going to be. I mean, think about the scale of economic activity that comes from having to make the transition for the entire energy system off of fossil fuel and onto something else. The upside potential is enormous.
I want to bring in another guest. Akshat Rathi is a reporter for Quartz based in London, and he recently wrote about China's carbon market, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Hey, explain what a carbon market is and how it works and why China is an important player here.
So, just for reference, China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet today. About 30% of all emissions come from China. And what it's doing with the carbon market is a simple mechanism. It's putting a price on carbon emissions so that companies can't pass the environmental costs of those emissions to the public the way they do today.
The way
the carbon market works is that you would have, say, a power plant, which emits maybe about 10 million tons of carbon dioxide each year. It would tell the government that this is the amount we are emitting currently. The government would say that we are going to give you a certain limit. You can only emit up to 9 million tons. We'll give you that for free. The 1 million tons on top, we'll put a price on that. And if you want to continue to emit, you will have to pay money to do it. Otherwise, you can implement policies or technologies that would reduce those emissions, and then you don't have to pay us any money.
So it's sort of a cap. It's a cap and trade system, then.
It's a cap and trade system.
Will this make the Chinese companies overall emit less?
Yes, I mean that's the hope. This is a market-friendly way of trying to reduce emissions. Once you start putting a price on carbon, there is more incentive to not put it out into the atmosphere as you can do today because there's no price on emissions. And once that price comes in, it disincentivizes companies to go on emitting as they do today.
Mm-hmm. Bill McKibben, what is your reaction to this? Is this a good idea?
China's doing all kinds of interesting things right now. They're fooling around with carbon markets and seeing how that works, although they've dropped back the scale a little bit from what they'd initially proposed. They're also putting up sun and wind power at extraordinary pace. Of course, some of that's driven by the fact that they managed to make their cities all but unlivable by burning so much fossil fuel. But it's also driven by the fact that they know that climate change is an existential threat. I mean, the Pearl River Delta, where their $1 trillion worth of manufacturing capacity is located, is
a meter or two above sea level. That's what they call it, Delta.
Akshat, do you think other countries will also join? Are there, you say China is the biggest player. Are there other bigger players that might do the same thing?
Definitely. Just the sheer scale of emissions that China is part of today. And yes, they've only applied this to the power sector, but even by just applying it to the power sector, they've already become the biggest carbon market. And look, at a time when the American government is sending signals to not act on the climate, if a bigger emitter than America comes on board and says that we are going to try and do our best to reduce those emissions, that's a very strong signal to the world that the world, apart from America, is very serious on climate action.
So this is more than just talking about it. This is actually showing that they're serious by taking action.
That's right. And China needs to do it because, you know, just as Bill said, they've been burning fossil fuels and it is harming their own people. You hear these stories about smog in Beijing or smog in Shanghai, and those images are real and those are being felt by the people. So even though it has a strong-handed government, it needs to keep its people happy. And reducing fossil fuel emissions does work in their favor.
Bill, can this be applied to American companies? Or
what can be applied is this kind of pincer action. Everybody's, you know, we can't do the most obvious thing that we should be doing, which is having a big concerted global action. We got a little bit of ways there with the Paris Accords, but of course Trump's doing everything he can to undercut that. So in the absence of a big global push to deal with what is, after all, the first truly global problem we ever faced, we instead have to find strategic points in which to work. And China is one of them, and that's why that the stuff that's being described that's happening in Beijing is of real interest. And just as they're the biggest emitter, New York is the biggest source of money on the planet for fossil fuel and everything else. If the center of the world's financial markets is sending the signal that we don't want to do this anymore, it's going to get harder and harder for the Exxons and Chevrons of the world to keep out there finding more fossil fuel that we don't need and can't burn.
Akshat, you agree?
And I would jump in. I would say that actually it's already happening in America. California is currently part of a carbon market that includes California and a handful of provinces in Canada. And they trade emissions, and California, as we know, is one of the best states on green action, on climate action. And so if California is showing to America that this is something that they can make it work within their economy and keep the economy growing, it's, again, a very strong signal for other states to step up and be part of this market. You know, even if the federal government has certain policies it can pass, states are quite powerful in what they can do to reduce emissions.
Akshat Rathi of Quartz and Bill McKibben, environmental advocate and co-founder of 350.org. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Have a happy holiday. When we come back, we're talking all about birds. What feathered friends are flying overhead right now? We'll answer your birding questions. It's our annual National Audubon Society bird count, winter bird count, Christmas bird count coming up. If you've got questions about what you're seeing in your backyard, we do want to know what you're seeing in your backyard. Give us a call, 844-724-8255. Maybe you're out there doing the bird count. Give us a call or send us a tweet at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The temperatures are dropping, the days are short, which means it's time for the winter bird migration and time for the flocks of birders to start making their birding list. And bird nerds around the country will be participating in the Audubon's annual Christmas bird count, tallying up what they're seeing. And that's what we do every year about this time. We become part of that bird count. And for the rest of the hour is going to the birds. We're going to talk about what birds you should keep an eye out for this holiday season and into the new year. And we want to know what birds you've been seeing. Our number, 844-724-8255. Every year we get some really interesting commentary of what's going on in bird feeders and people's homes and backyards and their wildlife areas around there. So give us a call, 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us. That's the right time to say that. You can tweet us at how unusual, SciFry, S-E-I-F-R-I. Let me introduce my guests. Drew Lanham is professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University in Clemson, South Carolina, and Laura Erickson, author of the National Geographic Pocket Guide to the Birds of North America. She's based out of Duluth, but she's here today in our CUNY studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Hi, Ira.
It's appropriate to tweet this time.
Right.
It's always appropriate to do. Drew, what birds have you been seeing out there in South Carolina so far this year?
Well, you know, Ira, it is winter. Didn't feel much like it on our Christmas bird count, which we just had this past Tuesday, the 19th. But the usual white-throated sparrows and savanna sparrows, the winter sparrows that have moved in, and then swelling numbers of residents. Things like common grackles and eastern meadowlarks that we normally see in some mm-hmm. of our agricultural areas. And then waterfowl. Waterfowl are beginning to push south.
Wow. And Laura, I know you hail from Minnesota.
Yeah, sure. You betcha.
I spent many years in Minnesota. There's something going on with the owls this year in Minnesota?
It's not just Minnesota. We're having a really wonderful snowy owl, what they call an eruption year. So they're turning up in all kinds of places. And it's been really exciting to follow them.
But send some down here, Laura.
I'll do my best. If I see one, I'll say, go to Drew's. But Duluth's Christmas bird count, I don't have all the numbers yet. They did that on the 16th. But they did have a boreal owl, which is a tiny, tiny little owl, and they're really exceptional. That was one of the rare times that they've showed up as early as the bird count.
Let's talk about this project studying the snowy owls called Project Snowstorm. What is that about?
They have put satellite transmitters on snowy owls, and they have a battery that is charged. It's a solar battery. Mm-hmm. And they track these individual birds that show up this year. They have funding to, I think, be tracking 8 of them from just Wisconsin. And they do them for wherever they have funding, and they do a lot in like Massachusetts and New York. And they're discovering all kinds of things about snowy owl migration that we never knew before.
Such as?
Well, we used to think that snowy owls came south on years when the lemming population had crashed in the Arctic and they just didn't have food. But we were starting to question that for, you know, several decades, because we'd get individuals that returned year after year after year just in the Duluth Harbor, and they were banded, so we knew they were the same birds. But we're also finding they have humongous reproduction in years when the lemmings are highest, and that's when they've produced so many babies, and they become kind of territorial in the winter, and the babies get pushed out, and that's when they come south.
Wow. Drew, the Christmas bird count happens, as I said before, every year this time. Were there any interesting trends from last season, the 2016 season, that you could report on?
Yeah, you know, Ira, the thing is that as you go out to the same habitats year after year, and oftentimes you'll have the same teams, so you divide that 15-mile diameter circle up into sectors, and you have teams that go out, and so folks who are familiar with not just the habitat but changes in it give us some good indication of what's happening. So this was really the first year in quite a few years that we've had decent weather. It was more like a spring count almost than a Christmas count. The temperature was up around 60. And so people were very comfortable out there counting birds. But one of the trends that we had this year, probably the most, I don't know, I wouldn't call it a disturbing trend, but from a compiler's point of view, man, it was hard to come by white-breasted nuthatches. You know, that little yank-yank bird, that little upside-down passerine that many of us find at our feeders. You know, it was hard to come by that bird this year, and last year we didn't have that issue. Last year it was more brown-headed nuthatches that we had trouble finding. So, you know, so for some of those common birds like nuthatches that you would expect to find, and not seeing those birds or hardly seeing them this year was a little troubling. But you know, that's a snapshot in time. What gives us the real indication of what's happening is when we begin to look at the long-standing trends of the Christmas bird count. So, you know, we hold out hope, for example, for things here like northern bobwhite. You know, poor bobwhite, and that bird we haven't seen on our counts here on the Clemson count in over a decade, and there's habitat here, and of course that's a bird that's familiar to many people across the United States that's just experienced these tremendous declines. So you keep looking. And you see little trends like the nuthatch from year to year, abundant last year, at least by our count, hard to find this year, and bobwhite quail that are, you know, almost like dodos, it seems. They're just harder and harder to find.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have a lot of people who are calling in with phone calls. Let's go to Rosemary in Evansville, Indiana. Hi, Rosemary. Are you there? Well, I tried again. Rosemary in Evansville, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay. My question is this. I live in southwestern Indiana, and the other day, I live in the country with a lot of hawks and other kinds of predatory birds around, and in the middle of the afternoon, I heard a bird I had never heard before, and it was very loud and as if, you know, like a hawk sounds in terms of the volume, but this bird went, ready? And I've never ever heard anything like that. And with changes in migratory patterns, I wondered if this was a bird that your guests could identify and tell me what it is.
Well, Laura, is that in your pocket guide?
It doesn't have sounds. Do you have a guess, Drew? I don't.
Wow, sounds like a bird in pain. to me, if I could ask our caller any other sort of identifying characters, what sort of habitat was the bird in? So, you know, we go through this sort of, you know, birder investigation, sort of this reductionist thing. What kind of habitat was the bird in, by chance?
Country, so I'm surrounded by fields and trees.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of hawks, other big predatory birds. And then, of course, we have the standard run-of-the-mill small birds that come through southern Indiana or live here all the time. We have a lot of owls. But I didn't think it was an owl because it's in the middle of the day.
Yeah, you know, I'm beginning to guess that weird sounds oftentimes, as you were talking about predatory birds and then you were talking about sounds, I was wondering if you were going to ask about blue jays maybe imitating a bird. But I'm going to go the corvid route. I'm going to go the crow route and wonder if you may have been hearing one of the many crow calls.
Wow.
They can do some peculiar things because they're extraordinarily intelligent, as we know, and have quite the vocabulary. So that's one guess that
All
I
right.
would put out there.
All right. Thanks.
The first part of it sounded like a sandhill crane, but then the second part doesn't at all. But that strengthens Drew's hypothesis that it was a crow mimicking a couple of things at the same
time.
They
are very smart, aren't those crows? Our friends over at the Brains On podcast, the podcast where kids interview scientists, looped us in with a few young birders who have questions for our guest today. Let's see if we can go to those questions. Are they on the line? Are kids on the line? Let's go right to them. Matthew, go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead, Matthew.
My name is Matthew, and I'm from Wheaton, Illinois. And my question is, how do birds know where to fly in the winter?
Oh, my goodness. Great question. You know, the thing is that birds have this, bird brains are wondrous things. So if anyone ever calls you a bird brain, first of all, say thank you for that. So there's, for some birds, there's this thing called hardwiring. A lot of us think of it as, the word is instinct, Matthew. And so that birds are sort of programmed in part by day length. So we just went through our winter solstice yesterday. And so as a lot of the birds up north, as day length begins to shorten, think of certain cues are turned on to help those birds move south, understand that they need to move south. So that's one of the ways that some birds move. So they kind of have to move, you know, and part of that, too, is related to resources that are available, food that's available for the birds. and the like. So over long periods of time, these migratory patterns and pathways have evolved, have developed in these birds. But then, you know, and Laura's lucky because she's still up there. She's up there in Duluth where you guys have got lots of common goldeneye, right, Laura?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, you think about waterfowl and ducks and geese, and those birds are cued to move in part by open water. So for a lot of times when those birds that we call facultative, that's a big word I know, but that they can make the choice to move, that they're pushed by certain cues, not necessarily instinctual or hardwired. So thinking about those ducks that are still in places that it's really cold and the days are short, but they're still open water. And then we begin to talk about things like climate change and global warming. And part of the reason that we're not getting as many ducks and waterfowl here in the South is that a lot of those birds are short-stopping. That is, that they are maybe coming south, but not as far south, because they're still finding open water.
Because it's warming. Warming's lasting. Water's lasting longer.
Yes, open. Indeed.
All right, let me get another question in from Sloan in Vancouver. Hi, Sloan. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Sloan. I am 8 years old. I live in North Vancouver, Canada. I love peregrine falcons and all birds of prey. My question is, what can I and others do to protect endangered birds of prey?
That's a really important question and an interesting one. The ways we help birds are sometimes by supporting programs that help them, by teaching other people about them. Peregrine falcons are doing much, much better today than they were when I was 8 years old, when they were wiped out of the whole eastern United States. No more were breeding in the eastern United States, and very few were breeding anywhere even in Canada except way far away from people. They've done really well because people have gotten involved in cities and outside of cities, helping to teach ones to grow up in the wild whose parents were falconers' birds that were taking care of them in captivity. And those have become wild, and we have way, way more now.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone. Let's go to Dave in Minnesota. Hi, Dave. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you very much. So I live in West Central Minnesota, and I've been here a few years, not many years, but I've watched the geese annually in the fall, late fall, fly south. And during the day, they just fly south more or less, and then in the evening, they'd go any direction you want, looking for water to stay overnight. The last 2 or 3 weeks, and particularly today, I've seen flock after flock fly due north, or very close to due north. So what was going on, and that's the first question. And the second question is sort of my own weird hypothesis, that do some birds find direction by basis of the magnetic properties of the earth? And if that's weakening, would that disrupt migrating birds, such as geese?
All right, let me remind everybody, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Oh, okay. Let me ask Laura from Minnesota, why are they flying north?
Geese learn their migration routes from their parents, and in Minnesota, we have quite a few geese that are pretty much non-migratory, and they, wherever they can count on having some open water in the winter, we have geese year-round now, and that probably will be increasing with climate change, but the ones in your area may just be moving back and forth from fields where they're feeding by day to where they have a good place to spend the night in water.
Mm-hmm. We caught up with Bill Doyle from the Santa Rosa Christmas Bird Count in Sonoma, California, one of the areas hard hit by wildfire this fall. They went out to count their birds last weekend, and here is his report.
Our species count this year was the lowest it's ever been historically. We just missed an awful lot of species that we normally would expect to see. That wasn't really a surprise because it's been going down year by year anyway. There are so many other impacts on birds besides the accidental ones like this fire. So whether or not it's due to the fire is really hard to say. It's certainly due to human impact of one kind or another.
Drew, any comment on that, what we know about the effects of the fires on bird populations?
Yeah, Ira, you know, it's interesting because, of course, those catastrophic fires that we saw out there have taken away a lot of the scrub habitat, obviously, that is actually meant to burn, but then a lot of the forest habitat, too, in these communities that we call pyrophytic, which is fire-loving. The issue is that, you know, we're in such weird cycles of climate now with warmer temperatures that exacerbate those fires. So what happens with birds, and they mentioned that there were lower numbers of many species, is that often you're going to see these dramatic changes. You're going to see the dramatic changes with lower numbers of some birds as scrub habitats, for example, are simply razed to the ground. They're erased. Or forested habitats become sparse or burn down or change dramatically. So I would predict, though, that as the habitats begin to regenerate, you'll begin to see different bird communities. Let's remember that forests and scrublands all across this continent are really maintained by fire. Again, the issues are the catastrophic nature of fire and, of course, the damage and destruction to humans. So we would expect changes, some temporary and short-term, others long-term.
All right, we're going to come back and talk more with Drew Lanham and Laura Erickson. It's our Christmas bird count this hour on Science Friday, 844-724-8255. Lots of people want to talk birds. You can also tweet us. See what I did there? At SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. This hour, we're talking about birding with the famous Christmas bird count. We've been talking with my guests, Drew Lanham and Laura Erickson. And now I want to bring on master birder Judith Bailey, joining us out near a lake in Austin, Texas. Hi, Judith.
Hi there, Ira.
So what are you seeing out there, Judith? Give us a field report.
Well, I have been out searching the three little lakes in our neighborhood, and it's been a rainy, cold Friday, and we've had some north wind, and I've had some new birds that have been showing up, so that's a fun thing. We've got wood ducks and gadwall and northern shovelers, canvasback, ringneck ducks, lesser scop, and then today I saw three female hooded mergansers, which is a real sort of coup for our neighborhood.
Why is that?
Well, they're kind of secretive ducks, and they like little ponds, and so we, you know, I guess we fit the bill. We've got a little pond, and there they were.
Now, I know you've been chasing a few birds down in South Texas.
I have.
Any luck spotting them? Tell us about that.
Well, Austin's not too far from the border down. We like to go to Laredo, and there are two birds, specialty birds, that are normally found in Mexico and Central America. One is a red-billed pigeon, and the other one is a white-collared seed eater. And there are not very many of them that show up in Texas. And so, you know, from like February and March, people go down to the border and try to find these birds. And I've been down there probably six or seven times and have had a local guide, and we go looking for these birds. And so far, I haven't seen either one.
Sorry to hear that. You've done a bird count near the coast of Texas. What trend have you seen there?
Well, I have been going to a place called Choke Canyon State Park, which is south of San Antonio and a little bit north of Corpus Christi. And I have seen, I guess I've been down there 9 years now. And when the Eagle Ford shale oil boom started, it included this area around the state park. And, you know, we have the same effects probably of climate change that other areas in the United States have. But this one, what I have seen and others have seen is that the noise pollution is the thing that is causing the big decrease and drop in the birding population. They can't, the trucking is so loud that, you know, the birds can't hear each other. And so the population is just, the species have gone down and the numbers of the species have gone down. This year, normally we see lots of Harris hawks, which are common to the area, and scissor-tail flycatchers, and there were none this year.
Wow, all that trucking noise. Well,
uh-huh.
Judith, good luck to you in your bird counting, and we wish you better luck.
Thank you so much. We're going to keep looking.
All right, Judith Bailey, master birder and field trip leader with the Travis Audubon Society, based out of Austin, Texas. We have another question coming in from our friends at the Brains On podcast, the podcast where kids interview scientists. On the line, we have James from Malibu, California on the line. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead with your question.
My question is, why are some birds shyer than the others? And I'm wondering this because in my backyard, I feed birds a lot, and we have a lot of types of seed, and some will only take a second or two, and some will pick up the seeds and see which one is heaviest, and, you know, they're real bold.
Yeah, so some will come right up to you, and some are very shy.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a great question, Judith. Why are some birds shy?
Well, you know, some birds like the jays are just bold by nature. And then there's, you know, smaller birds, little finches, and, you know, I think they're just probably shyer simply because of their size.
Let me ask Laura. Laura, what do you think?
It varies not only between species. Like she said, the jays can be not very shy, except at my feeders, the jays run off as soon as I go in the backyard to fill the feeder. They keep an eye on me, and as soon as it's filled and the coast is clear,
right,
they're back. But even with little birds like chickadees, there's an enormous amount of variation among the individuals. I used to open my window and put my hand out with mealworms, and chickadees would come to my hand to get the mealworms. Some would sit on my hand and weigh all the mealworms to get the heaviest one, and some would not even alight. They'd just grab it and fly off. I had one chickadee who was the boldest in one way. He or she would tap on the window to get my attention when it wanted mealworms. I'd crank open the window, but that chickadee would never alight on my hand. It wanted me to put my hand up right next to the branch where it wanted to sit. And so it wasn't afraid of my hand, but it must not have liked the feeling of human flesh on its feet or something. It would never land on my hand.
Well, to get birds to eat out of your hand, you must be the Mary Poppins of birds.
you know, Ira, here's the cool thing. And Laura talks about that variation within species. And there's a wonderful book, The Genius of Birds by Jennifer Ackerman, who... and she features Laura in that book, but she talks about these bird brains and this individual variation. So, you know, think about bird personality. I like to call them birdenalities, and that what we're learning about bird brains, again, is incredible. So, you know, yeah, shy species and wary species, but also how birds are exposed to humans. So one of the issues that we have on our bird count is whether or not the ducks have been hunted, whether they've been pressured the previous week or a few days before. So a lot of those ducks won't show up on perfectly suitable habitat because they have learned they've been pressured, and so they've become shyer. On the other hand, when you have ducks that have not been pressured, who have not been hunted over in many instances, then they tend not to be as shy. So all of this variation is something that's wonderful to keep track of, and I'm glad our young birders are doing that.
All right, I'm going to cycle through as many phone calls as I can because we have the lines are full, so I'm not going to talk about it. Let's go right to it. Let's go to James in Watertown, Connecticut. Hi, James.
Yes, it's Jamie. Hi.
I'm sorry.
I want to let you know that the bird I spotted 2 weeks ago, the beginning of December, was a full-tilt male bald eagle, and he had a wingspan span as long as I can put my arms out. He was right over my head. And so I was just curious, is it unusual to see a bald eagle this time of year in northwest Connecticut? I'm up in the northwest corner of Connecticut. Do they migrate or do they winter over in this area?
Yankee eagle, yes.
Well, they're migratory. So you've got birds that are moving, but you will have bald eagles that will hang around there. So yeah, she could be seeing either one of several birds.
Let's go to Dan in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Hi, Dan.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. Yeah, interesting. Last week, a big flock of medium-sized birds were just north of town. Have some salvageberry bushes. Thought they were great crown rosy finches at first as they come in. They ended up being a couple hundred cedar waxwings. Interesting, because we see them in the fall when the berries are ripe or overripe and eating those and even get a little bit tipsy. But this is the first time in living here a long time to see a big flock of cedar waxwings. They're great birds.
What do you say?
They're gorgeous.
Unusual this time of the year?
It depends on where you are. In Minnesota, cedar waxwings are very rare in winter. We get Bohemian waxwings. So depending on where you are, but they stick with around where they can find fruit.
Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer, Wisconsin. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Yay, birds. I love them. And we have a turkey in our neighborhood. It's Brown Deer, Wisconsin, north of Milwaukee, just like a suburb of Milwaukee. And it didn't look like the turkey I'd seen like 2 years ago wandering in our neighborhood. So, and it's amazing how well they fly. I just couldn't believe it when I was startled. But that's my question. I mean, that's my bird spotting, and I want I want to know how to see an owl. I
want
to know how to spot an owl.
Okay. First of all, she's surprised how high a turkey. I've seen turkeys 100 feet up in trees.
Yeah, they can fly.
I almost ran over two dozen of them the other day.
But. Domesticated ones have been bred for heavier meat, and so their wings can't pull them up. But wild turkeys do just fine. And they are becoming much more common in your neck of the woods in Wisconsin.
How does she see an owl?
Listen for swearing chickadees if you want to see a little owl, or swearing crows. And jays, good job, Drew.
I was out with my telescope the other night, and I heard the first time I've been living here 30 years, my first, the first time, like in the movies.
Like a great horned owl.
Yeah,
then
it must have
soft.
Been that, because I hadn't heard that.
Cool.
Before. All right, let's keep going, because a lot of people want to ask questions. Let's go to Pete in Meriden, Connecticut. Hi, Pete.
Hey, how you doing, Ira?
Go ahead.
Good, yes. Thank you for taking my call. Drew and Laura, just that caller who also called from Connecticut, we have a pair of nesting bald eagles.
Wow.
About a mile from my house. And last time I looked, they have gone, but there's still no ice on the pond. So they're probably gone because of the temperature. I can't say for sure, but I also frequent the Connecticut River quite often, and I haven't seen the bald eagles anymore, so I can only assume that they moved off because of temperature. However, the water is still open. So that would lead me to believe that they could still get food if they wanted to, but it's probably easier.
Oh, I guess I lost him. I lost.
You know, one of the interesting things about eagles, so that's a very astute observation. Sure, that the water is still open, that they could get fish. But bald eagles are also great carrion eaters. Not such a glorious picture of our national bird, but they are really opportunistic. So deer carcasses this time of year, you'll often find bald eagles on them. And in some places, the place to go to see bald eagles is landfills. So there you go.
Wow. Let's go to Morgan in Houston. Hi, Morgan. Megan.
Hi,
I'm sorry.
Megan.
It's Megan. I'm sorry. My glasses are not working today.
I've been seeing this really strange-looking bird around Houston only this week. It's about the size of a cardinal, and it also has the pointed feathers on its head. But it's mostly black and possibly some like dark speckled gray on its back.
Oh,
the tip of the tail is white. And then underneath the wings, there's this super bright, like reddish purplish color. And they have the prettiest song. And I've just never seen one before. And I wondered if you might know what it is.
That sounds like a phenopepla, doesn't it, Laura?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
A who?
A phenopepla.
Phenopepla.
I thought you were cursing or something.
They're actually not too distantly related from the cedar waxwings we were talking about earlier.
So Megan saw us a rare bird or some
for that area, it would be.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I want to go.
Good luck. Good luck, Megan. This is Science Friday at PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about what people are seeing, it looks like things are showing up where they shouldn't be. And people are seeing weird stuff. Right, Laura? I
mean, correct. Like the corncrake that turned up in New York last month on Long Island. That was an exceptionally rare bird that people actually flew in from all over the country to see.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was looking today at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released that Wisdom, a Laysan albatross, the world's oldest known breeding bird in the wild, has returned to Midway Atoll, the National Wildlife Refuge in Battle Midway National Memorial. This is almost a 67-year-old bird.
At least 67. Mm-hmm. The only known wild bird in the universe who is older than me.
But you're so young at heart, Laura. Come on.
She also laid an egg.
Yes, she's still
at
reproducing.
At 67?
And she's fledged 9 babies just since 2006.
How rare is that?
That her fecundity is really exceptional because many of them only breed every other year. Wow. So she's just doing amazingly.
Let me go through the phones again. I'm sorry to interrupt. Thomas in Cincinnati. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, Ira. How's it going?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Science Friday rules. You know, there's this bird that's by me, and it sounds just like a freaking cat, man. It's like,
like that?
And for sure. It's not... What bird is that then?
You're not going to believe it. It's a catbird.
A catbird?
Yep.
No way.
They're related to mockingbirds, and their call note is a meow.
So you must have been sitting in the catbird seat when you heard it then, so to speak. Thank you. We're running out of time for phone calls. Your final thoughts? Laura, and the bird count this year?
I'm looking forward to getting home to Minnesota to do the Isabella Christmas bird count. That's one way up in the north, and it's a guaranteed count. No pigeons, no house sparrows, and no starlings.
Anything? You've been in New York now visiting? Any birds you've seen?
I went to Jamaica Bay to go birding. Ooh. I love taking the subway to different birding spots. There wasn't anything rare this year. I spent Inauguration Day in January up in Arthur J. Hendrickson Park in Nassau County looking at a pink-footed goose.
My old stomping grounds. Okay. And Drew?
Wow. Well, you know, I am looking forward to the rest of this year, but this, you know, this count was special to me in part because I get to see old friends who love birds, but then you get new blood on occasion. You know, you get new folks coming in. So I had friends that came in from Atlanta, Georgia, and Athens, Georgia, to help me count birds, to help us count birds. And so, you know, birds, it amazes me how beautiful birds are and what they do for us ecologically in all sorts of ways, but then how they can bring people together. And so that's the thing that I absolutely love about Christmas bird counts is after you count all these birds, you spend a day working, watching birds, you get to gather around good food, good drink, and great people. So that's what I'm most happy about. This holiday season is the gift of birders.
Mm-hmm. And it's a gift that keeps on giving, as they say. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Drew Lanham, professor of wildlife ecology, Clemson University, and Laura Erickson, author of the National Geographic Pocket Guide to the Birds of North America. It's a nice little Bible there, based in Duluth, Minnesota. Happy holidays to both of you.
Thank you so much
Happy
for
holidays.
Having us.
And B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. That's when I say it's about all the time we have for this hour. If you missed any part of the program, you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. Maybe you'll get to hear the catbird noises. There's nice imitations there. And, of course, you can hear us anytime on Amazon Echo or Google Home. Every day now is Science Friday, and we're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can also email us. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave us a message and also join our mailing list. Have a great holiday weekend. If you're celebrating, a Merry Christmas to you. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.